This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to The Brains Behind It, the official podcast of BrainHackers.com. The source for smart strategies to improve your life, one brain hack at a time. In this podcast, we talk to the leaders and innovators behind great organizations and find out the secret to their success. Here's your host, editor-in-chief of BrainHackers.com, and two-time Guinness record holder for memory, Dave Farrow.
Hey there, Brain Hackers. Dave Farrow here with another Brains Behind It. You know that I love how the brain affects business and entrepreneurship. I've got a great interview here. Adam Belinich, he founded a company called Joyride Coffee, and he's president right now as well. And I think that I'm really going to enjoy this interview because he made the top 30 under 30 in Forbes, which is very cool. We're going to find out why that all happened. But what I just recently found out is that he also is he was a major in college. He majored in philosophy and fine arts. So of course you get into the coffee business. That just makes perfect sense to me. So I want to figure out, you know, how that goes in and how a philosophy major starts making coffee. There's got to be a philosophy behind it somewhere. So thank you very much for joining us on the show, Adam. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me, Dave.
All right. So tell us what makes Joyride Coffee cool. What's different about it, and how you started out.
Sure. So Joyride Coffee is an integrated beverage company. So we do not just coffee. We also sell kombucha as well as tea, largely to businesses, cafes, bars, restaurants, and then offices like JP Morgan or Twitter, for example. We started in 2010, actually, as a food truck on the streets of New York, selling frozen yogurt. And we needed something to fill the winter because it gets cold here.
Okay.
And also to sell something you could sell in the mornings.
Need so the hot we kinda, eat with the cool treats, right?
Yeah. That's exactly right. So we ended up adding coffee to the menu, and through a stroke of luck and a recommendation from a friend, we ended up in touch with a company called Stumptown, who's considered really at the forefront of the craft beverage movement. And from there, we were in the city and we realized people were leaving office buildings to come buy coffee from us. So they were coming from a place where the product was free to come pay for it. And we saw a market opportunity there. So we talked originally to Stumptown and said, hey, can we do office distribution for you? And they said, great, sure, go ahead. So we started there in about 2011. We ended up closing the truck pretty quickly after that. This was a definitely a better business, and the hours were better.
You just show up, drop off the box, and you go home. You don't have to.
That's exactly right.
You know, spend hours and hours sitting there. Well, what made the coffee better? Why were they coming to you instead of having it at their office?
So we were working with what is known as the third wave in coffee. This is people who are doing their own direct sourcing. Typically, the coffee is roasted more lightly. And there's just a more holistic approach to supply chain and to the quality of the products that they're making. So that's kind of what got us started. However, even from the very beginning, we were making a product that's now pretty common, but back in the day was just not that well known, called cold brew, which is a treatment of coffee. And we were selling glass growlers, first by the half gallon and then by the gallon, to these offices. In the summer of 2013, we were running into an issue, which is that some of our largest customers were literally limiting their purchasing because they had no more fridge space. And we saw this obviously as something that just can't stand. And so I work with my two brothers. They were the founders with me. So my older brother David says to my younger brother Noah, he goes, all right, we got to figure something out. So Noah slaps together a kegerator, the first model made with like plumbing parts because we were used to coffee brewers. And that it was all uphill from there, or all downhill from there. This is a method and a medium that really spoke to people. They really liked the products. And because you're reusing stainless kegs as opposed to doing single bottles, it allowed us to get economies on that end, which was better for the customer as well. So that's kind of so how we got the ball rolling.
I would have thought the standard corporate approach would be a vending machine. You know, they want to you install a vending machine, you're going to make a certain amount of profit from it. And you went with a kegger. Is that from your philosophy in college days or what?
That's a very good question. There's like a fun factor to it that people definitely enjoy, the self-serve aspect to it.
Yeah.
But the bigger thing for me was moving away from single serve because of the amount of plastic and packaging waste that you're generating. Yeah, right? A stainless steel keg has zero waste. Mm-hmm. It comes back, it gets cleaned, refilled, and goes back out. You know, and it can be replacing 160 bottles with one keg. Mm-hmm. So you're really doing a lot to kind of ease to improve the environment. And then it's also easier for customers to store so that they can have more product on hand. They spend less time stocking fridges or what have you.
And it's cheaper.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's cheaper.
And it allows you to distinguish yourself from your competitors. Even if it wasn't all those things, you're the guys who bring coffee in a keg. And then that makes it a conversation piece to spread the word about your business.
Yeah. So that format also led us into products that really required specialized handling, such as kombucha, fermented tea. And they fit very well into the same format because, you know, we're doing cold channel distribution to protect the integrity of the product. And kombucha, because it does have live cultures, requires that same cold channel. So it enabled us to, what started as really a coffee kegerator in the office has really broadened significantly from there to become a platform for drinking craft beverage more broadly. So whether it's coffee or tea or kombucha, what have you.
Yeah, just for the layperson out there, cold channel, as far as I understand it, I know from vaccines and stuff, is that you have to, or cold chain, is that you have to keep a product cold right from manufacturing all the way until it is consumed. And that is incredibly difficult. One of the reasons why vaccines don't make it to some parts of the world, because there's one little blip where they can't keep the thing cool. Things like that. Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. It does require a pretty high level of attention to detail to do it successfully, but it allows you to change the way that you're making these beverages. So for example, we make about 11 different cold brews, either under our own label or with various partners. And all these products are non-pasteurized. Now, how do we get that safely to a customer? We do it through that cold chain process. Mm. And through very clean and neat manufacturing practices, we're able to get a shelf life that makes this easy enough to handle that if somebody isn't worried about the product going bad in a week.
That's fantastic. So you put in the extra effort and then you found that you had a whole new field of product that nobody else can touch because kombucha requires that cold chain and there, nobody else has it.
That's exactly right. Even if you look at something like iced tea, if you were to go and buy an iced tea at your local store, you're mm-hmm. going to notice that it almost always will have two ingredients, one of which is going to be ascorbic acid, which is which is a preservative, essentially.
It's like vinegar.
Exactly right. And it stops the product from turning. However, that would obviously, if you add vinegar to your tea, you can imagine it makes it sour. So to balance it out, they add sugar. So now you go to a product, now you're drinking sugar, where maybe that wasn't what you're looking for. What you were looking for was iced tea. So similarly, this approach allows us to do away with these other ingredients and to make a product that has more integrity and that is really what our consumers are looking for, which are products that consider health, products that consider the environment. Mm-hmm. So it really has enabled us to kind of to get at the core of why people like working with us.
Yeah, and that actually makes a lot of sense. A lot of people wonder why can't they not add so much sugar to these things, and it's because of that spoiling. I actually every day I brew about 2.5 or a liter and a half of tea in two bottles. I keep it in the fridge, glass bottles that I reuse, then I have big coffee I carry with me, and I just make it myself and carry it around like a Sherpa, like carrying liquids from point to point. But but as a business owner and everything, I would probably be your primary a primary choice for that, because we all drink lots of coffee here, and everyone's weight conscious and everything. So getting rid of a couple hundred calories a day in useless sugar because you have to add that vinegar. Would be perfect. I can see that really spreading. That's brilliant.
Yeah. In a lot of locations, we're now starting to actually replace Coca-Cola machines. They are finding that the clientele, or rather, sorry, let me rephrase that. The employee base of these companies were just not drinking the product. So the single most used button on that Coke machine was seltzer.
Yeah, well, I mean, so many more people are health conscious, and so many more people, even Coke has adjusted by making their light product, low calorie and stuff like that, and people don't trust the zero calorie stuff. So yeah, you could fit in a perfect way. It'd be tough to expand that though. You're in New York, you're Manhattan. Sure. I mean, if somebody wants to do this in Houston, Texas, it'd be a little tough for you to serve that customer.
So we actually started in New York. However, in 2013, we expanded to San Francisco. Now we cover the entire Bay Area. We cover most of Southern California from Los Angeles through San Diego. In March, we just opened our Boston operation that'll cover everything within that 495 loop. Mm-hmm. And then in New York, we're everywhere from Connecticut to New Jersey. So I think we expect to see more expansion on the horizon. Mm-hmm. You're right. It is hard for me to get a product directly to someone in Houston. However, I believe there's a really strong value in recreating the supply chain elsewhere. And honestly, our customers agree.
What about franchising? Have you thought of franchising? Get somebody else to cover the costs of expanding to a new city?
So far we've been able to, we've bootstrapped this company ourselves from the very beginning, and we've been able to expanding it using the success of existing branches. I think we'd like to continue with that method. As I mentioned, we are a brewer and we are a distributor, and having tightly integrated supply chains, especially on something like a cold channel product, which does have a high cost to hold in terms of you're keeping this thing we now have multiple thousand square foot refrigerators just to hold these things. So, the shorter you can keep that supply chain, the less time product ends sitting on a shelf somewhere, and it keeps the product fresher. And it also means that, we're just lowering the cost of that consumer. So I would be concerned with the franchise model of the costs associated with expanding that supply chain.
Well, you can have 100% control of the product. You get to dictate, when you franchise. It's just that somebody else would cover the cost of expand. Somebody would want the Houston franchise or something, and they would cover it. But I can see how it'd be very tricky. But if you could get that formula to work, you would. You'd be, billions overnight, and I'm sure you'll get there at some point anyways. Okay, so on to some of my regular questions here. What's the best marketing? Actually, I'm gonna actually ask you a different one here. What's the smartest thing you ever did? Was it to realize that cold brew coffee was better than having a food truck?
So when I really think of that question, what comes to me is starting from a place of ignorance, like not assuming that you know what the answer is to begin with. And maybe this is where it gets into that whole the philosophy like aspect of it. But coming to the marketplace, we came into this industry without 30 years of experience doing
any
food distribution or whatever.
Yeah.
So the approach was always like assume that we don't know the right answer, and then try to figure out an answer. Listen to your customers. Listen to your employees. Be willing to test things out and then use empirical data to either validate or invalidate your ideas, because it's only through kind of acknowledging failure that you can continue to move forward. So that, it's not like one smart thing. It's more of like a theoretical approach to decision making. And I think that's really been what's made us successful.
Well, and also that's what made you think of making a keg when nobody else would have thought of that, And in the future, people are going to look back on why did nobody think of that? It's just because, nobody did it. Therefore, nobody thought outside the box. It needed someone from the outside. Do you think that an entrepreneur like the kegger idea, for example, do you think that your brain is different because of things like that, that you think of an answer that nobody else thought of, that you want to take a risk where other people want to play it safe? Do you think that an entrepreneur's brain is different for most people?
I think you need to be very comfortable with risk. Is probably where I would say it starts. However, I think most of the change happens after you've spent time doing it, right? Like the first time you take a lump from something going badly, it's really hard. But like the 300th time, you're used to it. This is, another day at the office. You just sip your coffee and move on.
Yeah.
So I would say it starts with a risk appetite, but then the kind of changes that make you look in this like, well, I don't really care what the answers have been way. I need to find what the answer should be. I think that's an approach that slowly you accumulate over time, largely through comfort with failure, honestly.
I like that term risk appetite. I think that's a really good way to say it, where a new entrepreneurs, they if they're given two options and one's more risky than the other, they almost, you know, chomping at the bit to try the risky one. Because, you know, with the greatest risk goes the greatest rewards, which is, of course, counter, you know, that's 5% of the population counter to 95% of people, what they would do. All right. So we talked about the common brain traits. Here's kind of a fun question. What do you have for breakfast first thing in the morning? Or if you don't have breakfast, what do you do first thing in the morning?
So I don't typically eat breakfast, much to my mother-in-law's chagrin. typically I get up, I row. I try to row every day. Oh, neat. I walk to work, which is about a mile and a half, which I find to be very, very helpful. And I would highly recommend it to anybody who can. It's a good time to kind of settle your mind and to chew over things you've been thinking about with fresh eyes in the morning. So that's usually what I do in the morning. And then obviously I'll have, I don't know, anywhere from 4 to 6 cups of coffee typically by noon.
There you go.
So that's my morning routine.
On a Sunday, though. Brand.
Yeah, absolutely. On a Sunday, though, for brunch, I'll have, you know, a bagel with lox. It's hard to beat. I'm a New Yorker at heart. It's just hard to get past that.
There you go. No, but I like that. Starting the day with exercise. I find a lot of successful people do that. I start the day with an exercise routine and stretching and changed my life. What do you think is the best way to motivate people? You know, so you've got some people on your team. You went from just having to motivate probably one person in a food truck to, you got a pretty big size team. How do you do it?
So the first thing in motivation for me is really the way that you recruit and who you recruit. Different people have different jobs, and the way that people succeed in those different jobs are very different, right? So what is success for a financial controller is things like accuracy, cost savings. What's success for somebody in sales is bringing on a new customer, a really good customer satisfaction. So what you need to do is find people who are naturally inclined towards what success means in the roles that they're in. So if you find somebody who just loves to find that dollar, he's going to be really happy if you put him in accounting. But if you have somebody who just loves interacting with customers and you put them in accounting, they're going to be miserable. That same person in sales is going to have massive success. So I think it really starts with recruiting, and the way that you then maintain it once they come on board is to give your team room, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you have somebody who's naturally inclined towards things that are valuable to your company and to their role that they have, giving them room to kind of take that same entrepreneurial mindset to say, hey, I don't really know what the answer is, but here are things we can try. And I think if you recruit right, you can find people who really love that freedom and that self-determination that you can get out of that. So I would say it really starts with recruiting, and then you have to give people who are the right fit room to try things out, and honestly room to fail sometimes.
Recruiting and give them space. That's fantastic. Yeah. I have a robotics startup. I do design engineering on the side, as only I would, but I have a programmer that I found, and the reason why I went with him is he said that I didn't have to pay him. He loved the project so much. He was so excited about it. He just wanted to work on it. And I said, well, you're the person who I'm going to pay then, you know?
Yeah.
And that's exactly it. Like he's solving a problem, you know, a technical problem, a software problem I was giving him was like just a dream come true for him, you know, this particular problem. So yeah, that's definitely the most important thing. I love it. Okay, so we've already found out something unexpected about you, that you you majored in philosophy and fine arts. Would you say that played any role in your business in this coffee business?
In certain ways, very directly. So you know, especially when we're starting out, I was doing all the graphic design work. You know, whether it was doing menu generation or whatever it was. So in certain ways, I had technical skills that were applied, but the more meaningful elements, I would say, or A, that approach from philosophy of assuming your own ignorance, which is, you know, as old as Socrates. And B, for something I think I experienced in fine art is understanding how to talk about something where there is no fact of the matter, right? Like many things are incredibly subjective. And if you can understand how to talk about them in a way that people find persuasive, that's helpful in things like sales, but it's also helpful in things like management and motivating people. It's trying to understand what matters to them and then how to tailor a message to be able to really tap into that.
Wow. Well, what you said is, I mean, that is the core of sales. is you know, find out what matters to the customer and talk to them about it and paint a picture and everything. And I never heard it described in a fine art, you know, format, you know, in a philosophical format. But, you know, the truth is truth, I guess, no matter what the category.
Well, that's the thing, is there actually is no truth. In art, like, the method for grading in fine arts is through something called a critique. You stand up in front of a board of 5 or 10 people and they try to tear you to pieces and you have to explain why you're right. Right. So like, understand, like, they're always going to come from some different angle. Mm-hmm. And trying to, and in fact, there never is a fact, right? Like, mm-hmm. the whole point of art is that it's subjective and you bring something to it.
That's the same, same in business too. You know,
that's exactly right.
There's a great history of, I believe it was Beyonce who went to a music school and she was like kicked out halfway through. And then later on when she's all famous, they bring her back to be like a judge and give her like an honorary degree and stuff because she just wasn't good enough then. Right. Apparently. So yeah, it definitely, I think that's why so many entrepreneurs really gravitate towards the idea of objectivism, that, you know, if they've sold a lot, that means they're good at what they do, you know, and that's the only measurement that they should have, not the opinions of others. But we could go on and on about that in today's social media world. But you probably get a lot of good feedback based on some of your innovations. Do you ever get any like negative feedback? Anybody who hates on you because of it?
In terms of I would say the most common point that people bring up is typically that they perceive this as a fad. I don't really, it's really hard for people to say that, you know, I hate this kegerator because, I mean, what is there really to hate? It's not really a risk. It doesn't challenge people.
Well, maybe you're ruining the integrity of my coffee and all that.
Oh,
you know.
You know, I guess I would take those things way more seriously if I didn't understand the degree of effort and complexity that goes into food safety and logistics. Like, it's, you know, like, you can, people, that's honestly, it's not a complaint we've ever really gotten because we did start at the high end of the market and maintain that same quality across every single product that we've done. I've never gotten that complaint.
Okay. Good then. But at the very least, they think it's a fad, and you'll just outlast that label. And already,
that's exactly right.
Already, the big guys are copying you somewhat with the cold brew options, and I'm sure they'll copy other options. I'm sure somebody will try to do a kegger as well. But there's a great phrase that the founder of Sony always said is that we can innovate faster than they can copy. So everybody wants to go with the original innovator. So you've also created a really, really tough barrier of entry for anybody to truly compete against you because of that cold chain. That's not something you can set up overnight. And if somebody tries to rush it, they could make a huge mistake. So you've really made it tough for your competitors to play in the same space as you. I think that's brilliant, especially for a smaller business.
Yeah, focusing on... Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. That one here.
I was going to say, focusing really... being specialized and focusing on what it is that you do well, playing to your strengths and not trying to kind of broaden it to provide commodity level services. That's really been a hallmark of our success. And that's really what has allowed us to, I would say, continue to pull away from our competition. There are already people who are emulating what we're doing. However, you know, we're steeped in this. This is for them, it might be 5% of what they do. For us, it's 100% of what they do. This is what I think about every day and every night. And that dedication is where those new ideas are coming from.
So the next time somebody says you're a fad, you just say, no, it's a fad. What my competitors are doing, for me, it's a business. You know,
that's exactly right.
Absolutely. All right. So going forward though, what's the best marketing hook that you've had? Obviously, you know, you've got some neat products, but the kegger isn't a hook. How do you get people interested in talking about your business and getting attention?
Sure. So probably the best thing that we did is to sit down and actually do the math. It, on the hot side, it was taking a box of K-cups, like those little pods, mm-hmm. and cutting them open and weighing out the ingredients of them to really find out how much they are a pound, so that you can give this customer an apples to apples comparison. Mm. On the cold side, it was understanding, okay, how many bottles are we really replacing? You know, how many fewer trash bags are they taking out a day? Mm-hmm. How many fewer pounds of waste are they generating a year? And humanizing that, you can say things like sustainability, right? But humanizing that to someone so that they understand this is what this does to me I think that was our biggest, that's really been our biggest hook, is like, is speaking to people in a language, speaking to people about values that matter to them in a language that they can relate to.
Yeah. Like the less sugar, you know, less calories, same taste, that sort of thing. Yeah. So just showing the numbers, and when you've got a better product, being able to whittle it down and really explain what makes it better. That's fantastic. So what's your marketing plan going forward? Expanding into any new areas? Do you have any other marketing ideas?
So in terms of going forward, we recently in Boston just retrofitted one of our distribution trucks to have taps along the side of it. So it currently has about 11 taps or 12 taps.
Wow. I forget
exactly which on the side of the truck. I know everything goes full circle from food truck to food truck.
Coffee on tap though is very tempting, you know?
Yeah. So it's, but you know, we're showing up with 12 different products. You're trying flavors of kombucha, three different cold brews, nitro green tea and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
And what this has allowed us to do is pull these tastings that we used to do in the customer office into the public domain. And in that way, these people are coming to this truck. It becomes a more specialized event. It's more for the office, it's more memorable. But then you also get the benefit of this visibility from everybody who's moving through this area. So if you're parking this truck in the financial district of Boston, you're going to have thousands and thousands and thousands of eyeballs on this thing every day. So that's something that we're still, I would say, prototyping and testing out. But that's something that we're going to be expanding to these, to all the rest of the markets, I would say, within the next year.
I actually have some great ideas when it comes to PR. I'd like to tell you about after the interview, but that is, that's a great way to kind of go out to the consumer. Cause right now you're B2B for the most part, and you want to get that consumer base in order to grow.
Yeah. So we are a business to business. However, what really drives our sales is the palates of the people consuming it, whether that's the clients of a cafe or the employees of an office. Most times it's the employee that pulls us into this office.
Yeah. Or you send a couple emails saying, hey guys, we should have these guys in the cafeteria, and you know, two or three people agree and they go for it. Right.
Well, it's that, but now we're also getting to a point where we've been in business long enough that we have certain clients who have gone through three different companies for a software developer, for example, and now we have three accounts. Because you deliver a high caliber product with good service, he moves on, takes it with you, you're delivering a high value product with good service. And that's that chain, it has to be earned through obviously doing what you do well. But it's absolutely wonderful in terms of what it does for your account base.
That's great. That's fantastic. So the best marketing hook you have is really being better than everything else.
Yeah. I know that's such a non-answer though.
Yeah, it's just like we market because we're better. Like objectively, we're better. Yeah. All right. Well, it's been fantastic chatting with you. Any final words, Adam?
For people thinking about entrepreneurship, probably the biggest thing I would say is expect failure and you need resilience. That's really the only thing that determines whether or not you succeed is how quickly you get up and how quickly you face to problems when there are problems. So
that's great words. Absolutely. Well, I had a great time talking to you. I'm talking to Adam Belenich. He is the founder and CEO of Joyride Coffee. Go check out joyridecoffee.com. And if anybody out there has some deep pockets and they want to convince this guy to start franchising, I want to be in that list as well, because I think coffee is the most consumed drug in the world and it's loved by everyone worldwide. And I think that this is finally a new take, a higher quality take that could just take over. So I think this is, I can't wait to see where you'll be a year from now or 2 years from now.
Well, expect more markets in the coming years.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for being on The Brains Behind It.
All right. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Thank you for listening to The Brains Behind It. And remember to check out brainhackers.com for more. If you have a suggestion for the next interview or comment, please email editor@brainhackers.com. If you want a free 30-minute marketing consultation from Dave Farrow and his team, then email editor@brainhackers.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.